And we'll go to the next case, Ute Indian Tribe versus McKee.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Frances Bassett, and I'm here today representing the Ute Indian Tribe of the Uinta and Ouray Reservation in Utah. I do plan to reserve 3 minutes as rebuttal. The issue in our appeal is whether the tribal court in this case had adjudicatory jurisdiction over the tribe's a claim that the tribe had brought against non-members for the theft of the tribe's federally decreed surface waters. The tribe's surface waters were being misappropriated by the appellees, who are non-members of the tribe. That's Mr. McKee and his business entities. Mr. McKee owns the fee property inside the boundaries of the reservation where the misappropriation occurred. At the two-day bench trial in the tribal court, the evidence was undisputed that all of these waters that flow through the Deep Creek Canal have been decreed to belong to the Ute Indian Tribe. That's the 1923 Cedar View Decree, which is in the appellate record.
I thought on page 174, I thought that the Cedarville Decree declared ownership of the United States in the BOI as trustee for the Ute Tribe.
Yes, that is true. But the ownership is
in the United States.
I'm sorry?
Is in the United States as the trustee for the tribe.
Yes. But I mean, we almost always refer in those sorts of cases as the tribe being the beneficial owner. So the
they certainly were the beneficial owners, I would think. But at page 171, the Cedarville Decree not only vests ownership in the United States as the trustee, but also specifically says that the allocation between the beneficial interests of the tribe and the other defendants will be determined under Utah law, correct? The page 171 of volume 2 of the appendix?
Are you quoting from the Cedarville Decree itself?
No, I'm going by memory. I could be mistaken, but my memory was that page 171, that the Cedarville Decree incorporated Utah law. And at page 174 was the language that you were referring to. Now, don't take my word for it. I'm not looking at it. That's my memory of it.
No, the Cedarville Decree does not incorporate Utah state law. I think that the court may be confusing that with the 1906 statute that authorized the construction of the Ute Indian Irrigation Project.
No, I know that does specifically incorporate Utah law. I guess I'm referring to page 174, page 7, that arrangements, parties shall be made and said water commissioner shall be further directed as to his duties, all by separate orders of this court, referring to the allocation. That's what I thought that it was referring to. And then in paragraph 8 on page 174, the rights and priorities of said defendants or against the plaintiffs are founded upon appropriations to the state engineer of the state of Utah and are subject to their exercise and are conditioned upon compliance with the provisions of the laws of the state of Utah relating to the appropriation. That's what I was referring to. Am I mistaken about the decree? And as you point out, the 1906 Act creating the project, both independently incorporating Utah law.
Yes, but I think it's applying Utah law for the non-Indians of water rights, because what you would have in this instance is the 1923 decree adjudicated the tribe's federally reserved Indian rights, and it quantified those. But it was not a general stream of adjudication, which is what would then occur is a determination of all of the correlative rights of all of the non-Indian users. But the 1923 decree makes clear that the tribe's water rights are the first in priority. They are the oldest water right, I guess, or the earliest water right in the stream. So I think it uses the word in there. We quote from that decree that says that the United States shall have the first and exclusive right to those waters for flowing from the Uinta and the Lake Fork rivers into the canal system that is the Ute Indian Irrigation Project. So I guess what the point that I'm making here is that all of the non-Indian water right holders are junior users. So
whether they're junior or senior, as the trustee, couldn't the United States in the 1941 water right and the 1943 and 1946 transfers, wouldn't the United States as trustee have been able to assign water rights to non-Indians?
And well, maybe our position is
a cause of action, say for breach of fiduciary duty or something like that, against the United States as trustee, but the trustee would have ownership and be able to transfer water rights to non-Indians, wouldn't they, if they were the owner of the water rights?
Well, what the 1941 Act allowed was it allowed the Secretary of the Interior to transfer water rights within the project. And the fee lands owned by Mr. McKee lie outside of the Ute Indian Irrigation Project. And that was established fairly definitively in the tribal court. Because what happened is, and we've sort of listed out the chronology in our brief, but in 1905, the United States did submit an application for appropriation to the Utah State Water Engineer. But it did that because at that time, the understanding was that the Indians' water rights would be determined in reference to state law. That was 3 years before the United States Supreme Court ruling in the Winters case. And Winters changed all of that significantly by holding that Indian water rights are deemed to have been reserved at the time the reservation was established. So this reservation was established by executive order, later affirmed by Congress in statute in 1861. So the Ute tribe does have the earliest priority date of its water uses.
But they don't have a right to every drop of water that comes out. They have to put it to a beneficial use, don't they?
No, Your Honor, that is not true. That later on, and I believe we cite the case of Arizona v. California, because this issue had arisen in that case as to what exactly are, how are Indian reserve water rights characterized. And the United States Supreme Court ruled in Arizona v. California that Indian water rights are presently perfected water rights. So that means that they do not have to be applied or perfected through beneficial use, and they cannot be forfeited through non-use. And so that's been the law ever since Arizona v. California, which is cited in our briefs.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. So
yes.
I'm going to give it to you that everyone is junior to your clients as far as the water rights deriving from the two streams that ultimately end up in your canal. Is it your position that if someone upstream on lands outside the reservation's exterior boundaries is diverting water and cutting into your client's use, that they're subject to tribal court jurisdiction?
I don't I don't think that we take that position in this lawsuit because you're talking about something upstream. Mr. McKee's property is not upstream to the reservation itself. It's not at the headwaters of either the river or this canal itself. I think the evidence was undisputed in the tribal court that the only waters that are conveyed through the Deep Creek Canal are tribal waters, other than if there is a carriage agreement with some upstream, I guess, water right holder. But the tribe's water engineer, Dr. Messigahana, had looked into that to see if there were any carriage rights for Mr. McKee's water, and there are none. So there was no right for Mr. McKee to be diverting water from the Deep Creek Canal, other than for the bottom 40 acres, he did claim a right through those transfers that were made under the 1941 Act. And that gets me back to Judge Bachrach's question. Our reading of the 1941 statute is twofold. Number one, it has to have the consent of all affected parties. And our position is that the tribe was certainly, this is the tribe's water, so the tribe is certainly an affected party. And the tribe's signature is not on those assignments. But secondly, that the statute itself limited the secretary's authority. He could only transfer water to other lands within the project. The McKee land was outside of the project. The project lands include the Indian allotment and former allotment lands. So we believe that, and we argued, and in fact, the tribal court found that, it found two things. It found that the tribe had not consented to the transfers, and that the transfers were not made consistent with the secretary's authority, because this was a transfer outside of project lands. And then thirdly, we presented the entire chain of title for that property at the preliminary injunction hearing in this case. Mr. McKee himself admitted under oath that he did not have a conveyance instrument for those waters to that lower 40 acres of property. The chain of title does not contain any clear conveyance of those water rights into Mr. McKee himself.
Why is any of that relevant? After all, the judge specifically declined to decide whether or not Mr. McKee had violated any, had diverted excess water or improperly diverted water. And the only issue, as I understand it, that we are to decide and that the district court decided is, did the tribal court have adjudicative jurisdiction, and whether Mr. McKee had any water rights, whether he violated, whether he exceeded whatever water rights he had, seems to me to be a purely merits question. The tribe either had adjudicative authority or it didn't. Whether or not Mr. McKee is a wrongdoer seems completely irrelevant to me, although both sides have spent so much in your briefing and today talking about that. Maybe I'm wrong about that. How is it relevant to jurisdiction?
How is...
whether he diverted any water rights or had title.
You're right. That does go to the merits. What happened when we got to the federal district court is that the entire case was essentially relitigated. So there also seemed to be confusion because the transfers under the 1941 Act only purported to transfer water to the bottom 40 acres. And Mr. McKee was diverting water to all of the property. So there was also that distinction. But I do agree that it goes more to the merits than to the jurisdiction itself.
Before we run out of time, I want to make sure, counsel, that we get an answer to what I was asking you about earlier. And I think you said this isn't your position, but it seems from your briefing that your position is that if there's an allegation that the tribe's water rights are being taken, that the tribe has plenary authority to adjudicate that. And I want to make sure that you're limiting that argument to claims within the boundaries of the reservation and not just saying that, hey, look, if it's our water and we're claiming you took it, there's tribal court jurisdiction.
That is correct, Your Honor. I mean, we are only refer the tribe's authority pertains to the lands within its exterior boundaries. We are not making any claim that the tribe would have regulatory or adjudicative authority outside of its exterior boundaries. That is correct. Mr. McKee's property, however, is within those exterior boundaries.
Okay, so if he was diverting what you thought was the tribe's water, but the diversion and application was occurring outside the exterior boundary of the reservation, you would not claim there was tribal court jurisdiction over that. Is that right?
If the water was being diverted from inside the reservation,
outside. If the diversion and the application are occurring outside the boundaries of the reservation under my hypothetical. But it's undisputed. I mean, you contend that it's the tribe's water.
Yes. In the Ute Tribe cases, there's Ute Tribe of Utah. I think we may cite those in our briefs. But in the Ute 5 case, the 10th Circuit ruled that although lands have been patented in fee inside of the exterior boundaries, the exterior boundaries themselves remain intact. So our position is that the tribe would have that authority within the exterior boundaries of its reservation, but not outside of the exterior boundaries.
Okay. I think you've answered my question. Thanks.
Even if I just want to make sure I understand. So even if he's creating ditches on fee land, non-Indian land, on his lot, would that come within the tribe's adjudicative authority? Even if he may be diverting water from the Deep Creek Canal that you say is Indian, Ute Tribe's water, but he's not. Doing anything outside his fee simple. He's creating the ditches on his own land, not tribal land. Do you have adjudicative authority over that?
We believe so because it is tribal water that is being misappropriated. And we realized that the legal argument varied between the upper 80 acres and the bottom 40 acres. And the tribal court did address those separately. We think for sure that the tribal court would have adjudicatory and regulatory authority with respect to the upper 80 acres for sure.
Okay. Let me ask one other question. I know we went over time and I'm going to give the appellee additional time, but here's my question, Ms. Bassett. You mentioned that the 1923 decree quantifies the winner's the water right of the Ute tribe, and I think that's right. There's a certain number, I forget what it is, that's attributable to the beneficial interest of the tribe. How do we know whether or not the water that Mr. McKee was diverted, that water at issue, was that water or not?
Because the only water I would grant you that would be a reasonable question if the diversion was coming from the rivers themselves, but it's not. The diversion is from the Deep Creek Canal, and the Deep Creek Canal carries only tribal waters.
Well, you rely on the winner's doctrine for that, right?
Well, not just the winner's doctrine, but the decree itself, because the decree, what the 1923 decree is doing is it's adjudicating to the United States as trustee for the tribe so a certain diversions from the two rivers, the Uinta River and the Lake Fork, I believe it is. I may have those wrong. But so those, the diversion is being made from the water or from the rivers into those conveyance channels. And the only waters to be carried through those channels are tribal waters. The Deep Creek Canal is specifically identified as one of the canals in the 1923 decree. And that decree also identifies by reference to the 1905 Certificate of Appropriation, the lands that are entitled to receive those waters. Mr. McKee's land is not on that. So Mr. McKee's land is not land that is entitled to receive water through the Deep Creek Canal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Judge.
Could I add one thing just very quickly? Sure. Because if there is not tribal court jurisdiction, we had moved to amend our complaint to bring these claims in federal court. It's clear that there would be federal court jurisdiction. We believe the district court improperly dismissed our complaint with prejudice without allowing us to amend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Benson. Judge Carson, it will stop the clock on that. Judge Carson, do you have any questions?
I'm not Judge Carson.
I don't have anything further.
Judge Kelly?
I'm Judge Kelly.
He was asking me.
Yeah. I was talking to the bald-headed guy.
Oh.
Now I'll ask the old guy. Do you have any questions,
no.
Judge Kelly? And I'm just teasing both of you. We'll give, I'm going to give an additional 6 minutes to Mr. Smith.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Craig Smith on behalf of the McKee defendants. Where we start with this analysis is McKee is not a tribal member, and the activities that are complained of are not on tribal land. They're on his fee land that he owns that is within the boundaries of, but not tribal land. And we look now to this water. The water comes through the Deep Creek Canal. The Deep Creek Canal is part of the Uinta, not Ute, but Uinta Irrigation, Indian Irrigation Project. And if you look at the law under which that project was created, it has a couple of important things that later courts have upheld. One is that the water was to be appropriated and administered under state law. At that time, there was no reservation because that had been dissolved in 1905. It wasn't reestablished in 1945. So they weren't doing anything for the tribe. It was for the Indians of the former reservation. Another thing that's really important in the 1906 legislation is it allows and provides for providing water to non-Indians, people that are today not members of the tribe. So this water isn't the exclusive water of just for tribal members. And in fact, if you look at the Hackford case that the circuit did, it explains a lot of that history. And it also goes on to say that Indians and tribe are not synonymous. And under the Hackford case, Mr. Hackford was a mixed blood who was getting water from this project. He's not a member of the tribe. He complained. He didn't want to pay his assessments to get the water that was being delivered. That's what that case was about. They said, no, you can't bypass the system that's been set up under the 1906 legislation. The system is through the project, through the Secretary of the Interior who administers it, not the tribe. Secretary of Interior administers the water. Now, it is in trust for the tribe. I'm sorry, for the Indians, but not for the tribe. And so Mr. Hackford could not get his water for free. He had to pay like tribal members do, non-tribal members do. People like Mr. McKee have to pay for that. And so it's not managed solely for the tribe. This water is managed for the tribe and a lot of other people that have never been tribal members or could never be tribal members like Mr. McKee.
So do you disagree that this lateral that Mr. McKee is taking water from carries only tribal water?
Well, I disagree because it's never been determined to be tribal water. Now, we have to get, remember, this was water for the Indians at the time for the former reservation. If you look at that, you look at the CW decree, it says trustee of the Indians of the former Uinta-Noray Reservation. And again, specifically in 1906, they said, go appropriate water and build a system that will serve both Indians and non-Indians. And that was, again, that was upheld by this court in the Hackford case where, you know, again, Mr. Hackford was, he's not a member of the tribe. He was, but he's still entitled to get water as long as he pays assessments. And then more recently, I want to bring to the court's attention that in the one, there's a federal district court case that's mentioned in the Utah district court opinion here. It's back in D.C. in the D.C. district. There was a ruling in that case that I think it bears on things we're talking about today. This is a case where the Ute tribe sued the Secretary of the Interior and others claiming breach of trust duties. And some of the trust duties they claimed the breach of was serving non-tribal members without consulting the tribe, two, failure to recognize the tribe's sovereign authority to administer water, and three, failed to protect and develop water rights. That's what they claimed the Secretary of the Interior was doing. The D.C. court, and I'm going to give you the citation of that case. It's number 1:18-CV-00547 in the District of Columbia District Court. In a ruling on just September 15th, just a few days ago, they dismissed those claims. They dismissed those claims because they said, you know, again, and one of the sources of the trust, the trust obligations that the tribe claim was being violated by the Secretary of the Interior was this 1906 legislation. And that court found that under that 1906 legislation, the Interior could serve non-members of the tribe with this water, just like Mr. McKee being, I guess, one of those. And it serves a lot of other non-members of the tribe. And so it's for the benefit, and the court found that the Uinta Irrigation Project is for the benefit of both Indian and non-Indian water users. That's what that project's for. That's what that's water for. So this was an argument that was made by the tribe to the district court. Now, again, that's just a district court. It's not precedent here, but again, it's consistent with all the other rulings. Consistent with the fact that during this whole period of time from 1905 to 1945, there wasn't a reservation. And that's what,
you know. I don't want you to lose your train of thought. In fact, within 5 business days, would you give us a copy of that district court opinion?
Yes, I'm happy to, Your Honor.
Get in a 28-J letter. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So then we go to this. Where are we at? We look at the jurisdiction of the tribe. Let's go to the Montana exceptions, because that's where they have to find jurisdiction. As this court held in 2007 in the MacArthur case, you look at Montana to try to assert jurisdiction over non-members. In 2008, Plains Commerce, United States Supreme Court actually agreed with the MacArthur decision and said this is a path-making case as far as the Montana exception. So let's look at the Montana exceptions. Now we know that you have, under the Montana exceptions, are very limited. There are very limited situations where a tribal court can assert jurisdiction over a non-tribal member. Let's look at the two that they get. One is the, and again, Cooley, just recently, United States Supreme Court Cooley said, yeah, look at Montana exceptions to try to assert jurisdiction. Is there a consensual relation? No consensual relationship with McKee and the tribe that has anything to do with this, what they went after him for, which is the taking of water out of the Deep Creek Canal. He did lease other land, not related 3 miles away. He did have, they claimed some sort of relationship with Mr. Arrochis. Again, that was to farm Mr. Arrochis's land, not this land. So there's no consensual relationship.
Mr. Smith, what if hypothetically one of the other leases or with Mr. Arrochis, let's just take the lease agreements. Hypothetically, if the lease agreement included a covenant that I, Mr. McKee, hereby agree not to take any water out of a deep creek canal. And the lease does not cover any of the acreage in which he had these this ditch to divert the water. Would that have created, under the first Montana exception, would that have triggered the first Montana exception?
Yeah, I think it likely would, because the agreement would be related to actions that he's doing. I think there would be that connection there, because but those leases don't say that. They have nothing to do with his use of water on his fee land that he takes from the canal. So they don't have that. But I think the court's right. I think under that exception would be met if there was some relevance. Again, you know, when you look at the case, it's the Atkinson, I'm trying to remember the name of the case, where the Supreme Court looked at the motel that was in the middle of the Navajo reservation, and there were lots of other contacts, but they couldn't tax that motel because it was on non-tribal land. If you look at that case. So then we go to the second Montana exception. And again, that's very limited. This court recently ruled on that in the Norton case and dismissed the only claim they thought was plausible in that case. There was a lot of claims against this. This is where the very unfortunate incident occurred, where a tribal member was killed on tribal land by a police officer, or by a non-tribal officer, by a state officer. And they made a lot of claims. The only one the court found had any plausible jurisdiction was the trespass claim on tribal land. We don't have any trespass here. Now, in Cooley, they say, well, this second exception is wider, but the Cooley facts are not here. The Cooley facts in the United States Supreme Court case that came out this year, the Cooley facts are to a ability to stop somebody, or, you know, stop somebody or detain somebody by a tribal officer who's not a member, so you can turn them over to the right authorities, which would be the non-tribal authorities. Again, what they want to do is subject Mr. McKee to a court that he has no membership say in. It's not any political say in it, no role in that court. He is not part of that court at all. And that's why they think he should be, again, they do not have regulate that authority under him. They don't meet those exceptions. This does not affect the governance of the tribe, because the tribe, again, doesn't manage these water rights. These are managed by the Secretary of the Interior through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And that's how the water rights that were appropriated and this whole project, they're managed by that, and they're administered under state law. What the tribe didn't tell you is that there were change applications and continue to be change applications filed with the state engineer of Utah anytime they want to do something different with this water. And when it was approved through one of those change applications filed by the federal government, filed by the trustee, to allow to give permission to use water on the McKee land. That's the administration process at the state.
Counselor, could I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
Was it alleged in the complaint that the economic security or health or welfare of the tribe was being affected by this taking?
I think they just said, yeah, water is important, so it does affect us. I mean, that's kind of, it was very conclusory, but I think there was that kind of a statement that, you know, any drop of water, even though this is a drop compared to thousands and thousands of acre feet of water that are in this project alone, but they did make some sort of, there is a passing reference, I think, to, you know, does affect us because, you know, water is important, and we all know water is important. That was the kind of passing sort of reference that we have from the tribe. But, you know, you have to take Mr. Key. He has like 128 acres. This is not a big deal. And again, this is not managed by the tribe. This is managed by the secretary. What the tribe's real complaint is against the Secretary of the Interior. They don't like the way she is managing their water, what they consider to be their water. And so they sued the Secretary of the Interior in the district court. By the way, that same case I mentioned in the District of Columbia, the other ruling that was made by the court on September 15th was to transfer that case to the District of Utah. So that case is going to be heard within the umbrella of this court. What's left of it? Not much is left of it. Much of it, like I said, much of it was dismissed either. And what the court, one of the other things the District of Columbia found was there wasn't a specific trust duty of the United States in managing this water. They pointed to the 1906 legislation. They pointed to other things the tribe did, and none of those created the kind of specific trust duty that they could bring a claim that hey, Secretary of Interior, you are violating your trust obligations to the tribe by serving this water to non-Indians.
Before you get to that, I want to, before you go on, I want to go back in your answer to the health and welfare that Judge Kelly is asking about. And you mentioned that, well, this is not a big deal. He's only got 121 acres. Now, if he had diverted, say, a lot more water, could the quantity of water that was taken out of the Deep Creek Canal, could that theoretically have affected the welfare of the Ute tribe? The second Montana exception?
I believe it could. If it was a lot. I mean, again, we're talking about things that are kind of catastrophic and go to their whole economy. I think the level there is way above where we are.
Right. Okay. How we are. Therein lies the rub. When the tribe exercises its adjudicative authority, when it begins, it obviously doesn't know what the facts will yield. And so how does the tribe know that it's not going to be a big deal because he only diverted a little bit of water out of the Deep Creek Canal? It doesn't know that before it exercises jurisdiction.
Well, I think, if the complaint was brought against Mr. McKee said he was diverting, you know, thousands and thousands of acre feet, they could do that. And again, they could know that.
Okay, so the question then for the second Montana exception is that we need to look to something that's really not been cited in any of the briefs, and that is the complaint or the petition that was filed in tribal court, and assume the truth of those allegations in the tribal complaint, and there make our own independent judgment of whether or not the allegations, if proven true in tribal court, would be sufficient to implicate the welfare of the tribe. Is that the inquiry?
Well, yeah, I think that's basically the inquiry. But again, they didn't make allegations beyond one person and 108 acres or whatever he owns. Again, they know what the test is, so they'd have to make allegations of this, you know, severe impact on the economy of the tribe. The other thing I want to point out is your adjudicatory jurisdiction does not exceed your regulatory jurisdiction. They have no regulatory jurisdiction over this water. It is either the Secretary of the Interior under the 1906 who manages it, or the state engineer under that same legislation that says you're going to go appropriate this water under Utah state law, and it's going to be managed, it's going to be administered under Utah state law. And that's how it's always been administered since then. When they want to change the point of diversion, place of use, nature of use, all the things that you have to go through the state engineer in Utah who administers the water, that's what's happened to these water rights in this project, because that's what how it was set up. So the tribe is trying to come up with adjudicatory authority when they have no regulatory authority, because the regulatory authority is held by two different parties, neither of which are the tribe.
Now, could the tribe have gone into the Utah state system with the state engineer and had an adjudication by the state engineer on the issue?
Yes, they could raise it. In fact, under state law, the tribe, if they think Utah law has very robust and severe penalties for people taking water that they're not entitled to. There's both criminal and civil penalties under Utah law. There is an enforcement section of the Division of Water Rights State Engineer, an enforcement engineer, and you can go online and make a complaint that somebody is using water they're not entitled to. The tribe could fully use that system or the court systems of the state of Utah if it chose to do so, but instead it chose to bring the action in tribal court and not in the state court or in the administrative enforcement system, again, which has both criminal and civil penalties, and they are severe penalties. This is not like you just take whatever water you want in Utah and just get away with it. These are severe penalties, and they have an enforcement mechanism. You don't even have to leave your chair. You can just get on your computer, make that complaint, and it's investigated. Tribe never did that. Again, that's what had gone under the 1906 legislation.
The tribe is not entitled to an unlimited amount of water, are they?
No.
No, everybody's water rights are limited by it. To fulfill the purpose of the reservation.
Yeah. And you know, the tribe's winter's water has never been determined, because what that water is because the Congress and the state of Utah thought they had a compact, and they passed it both in Congress, state of Utah, They thought they'd worked out a compact with the tribe. The tribe refused to sign the compact. So that compact has never come into place. And we've never had a determination, so to speak, as to what the tribe's winter's water rights are.
I thought it was the 1923 Cedarville decree. There is a reference to the quantity of the tribe's beneficial interest in the water.
Yeah, I don't think that's all of the tribe's water rights, but you're right. In that decree, they decreed some of the water rights to the tribe. In this drainage, they certainly did. And again, they said this is again it was not the tribe, but with the Secretary of Interior went in and got the decree that you couldn't. Again, made this water right the prior water rights. But again, you have to remember these water rights were appropriated for both Indians and non-Indians, as two courts have already found and as said in the 1906 legislation that created this project.
As Ms. Bassett points out, it does say, I think it's on page 171, that the Indians of this reservation do have a first priority. And she says that all of the water in the Deep Creek Canal would fall under that umbrella of the winter's rights. What's your response to that?
Well, I think it does say that the first priority goes to the Indians. And again, that was then again, and you have to remember that was in the context of there not being a reservation at that time. Also in the context of the 1906 legislation, because you know, you can only really serve water canal where the water would run to. So they tied it to land, Indian and non-Indian, not just, you know, because that's what the canal is. And so, again, we had no reservation at that time. And we also had a situation where the legislation that empowered this said you can serve Indians and non-Indians. It would be up to the Secretary to determine, I think, that question. Again, they don't like the way the tribe doesn't like the way the Secretary has determined and administered these water rights. That's why they sued the secretary. So far, they haven't been successful. Obviously, they can't have the field rights, but Mr. McKee is caught between, you know, what they're trying to do is kind of make an end run around the federal government here and how they're managing their water rights and hold Mr. McKee responsible for things that if they're unhappy with, it should be the secretary. They should go to the secretary and say, Ms. Secretary, that water shouldn't be going to non-Indians. That should be going just to us. We don't have enough water to go to us. You're the Secretary of the Interior. You're administering this. You're managing this project. That's where the water should go solely to tribal members, not to half-bloods like Mr. Hackford, not to non-members like Mr. McKee and many, many others, just to us. They haven't been successful in doing that or wresting that power away. And so that's why they come after Mr. McKee, who's just a customer. He buys water from the BIA under a contract that was done in the 1940s that ran with the land. He's just a customer. He's not at fault here. And there's many, many others they could have gone after. I don't know why they chose Mr. McKee, but they chose him. And again, they claim he's stealing whatever they claim he's doing. But Mr. McKee was simply a customer of the United States who sell him water. They continue to sell him. They sell him water to this very day, as long as he pays his assessments. And so for all those reasons, my time is up. For all those reasons, the district court in Utah got this right. There is no tribal jurisdiction over Mr. McKee. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Kelly, do you have any questions?
No.
See, I knew who you were. Judge Carson, do you have any questions?
No, thanks.
All right. Melissa, I think Ms. Bassett's out of time. Is that right? Well, I know she is because I think we went 6 minutes over.
Could I just say one thing very quickly? I would give the panel, it is not true that the state of Utah has regulatory authority over the tribe's waters. And I would refer the panel to 25 USC, section 1321B and 1322B. That is public law 280. And in that statute, Congress specifically exempts state authority over tribal waters.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, it says that nothing in this section is authorized to vest Utah law, is authorized to incorporate Utah law, right? So 1321 specifically says that it should not be interpreted as a creation, as to justify applying Utah law. It doesn't say the Utah law doesn't apply for example, if it had already been incorporated in the 1906 statute.
Yes, but the 1906 statute itself does not confer that kind of authority on the state of Utah.
Okay, thank you very much. I will say that I thought the briefing and your oral arguments today were just exceptional for both sides, and we appreciate your really tremendous preparation to do that in this very important case for both sides. Thank you.
Thank you.